91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Most everyone has felt anxiety upon being the newcomer. It may have been in a school or neighborhood or a new job or in a strange social setting. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll get tips on how to better adjust to new settings from occupational researcher Keith Rohlig, who's written What to Do When You're New, How to Be Comfortable, Confident, and Successful in New Situations, and more. Resident chef and columnist Linda Gassenheimers clears up a mystery of Deep South Dade. What's behind the oddly named Robert Is Here fruit stand? It's part of rich Redland history. And the popular stand's owner, Robert Moling. So stay with us. Topical Currents up next after the news. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Bonnie, it's so good to have you back with us and feeling chipper and looking so nice.
Thank you so much. Well, you know what that fanfare was for that Paul just played?
Oh, the breaking news item that you have.
Yeah, it's not because I'm back.
Right, it's for the breaking news about WLRN.
That's right. So we are thrilled to announce that just as of now, WLRN can now be heard by our listeners in Palm Beach County, two places, 90.7 HD2 in West Palm Beach and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. So that's two places that we can be heard.
And those frequencies again?
They're 90.7, that's HD2, which you can get on an HD radio or on many car radios, or 101.9 FM, that's NPR, for the Palm Beaches. So we welcome our new listeners, and we know you'll appreciate the best in public radio programming, the news, information, and entertainment.
We're really filling quite a void there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Well, let's get back to our program now. It's natural to be uncertain in new situations, in new jobs, or with unknown people. In fact, that feeling of anxiety is in our genetic makeup. So we'll learn more about how to better cope in new settings from Keith Rohlig.
He's a researcher, consultant, and educator who's an expert in newcomer success. He's written What to Do When You're New, How to Be Comfortable, Confident, and Successful in New Situations. And he joins us now from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you for being with us. As we mentioned, we are hardwired to fear the familiar. It was a survival mechanism. But why don't you give us a little primer on that?
Sure. If you think about it, for much of human history, people lived in very small groups out in the wilderness, hunting and gathering food, probably 25 to 50 people. And most people were only knew a few times in their life and probably met at most maybe a hundred or two strangers throughout that life as well. And we evolved over time because meeting strangers was such a significant and often stressful event back then, because it usually meant we were either encroaching on somebody else's territory or they were encroaching on ours. We've evolved to have a natural anxiety around strangers. And while that can be a helpful thing at times, we now have carried that into a world, a modern world, where we are literally around strangers all the time. And in fact, most of us just going about life will probably interact with more strangers in a week than our ancestors did for an entire year. And that's part of that makeup that makes us a little hardwired to be nervous in new situations.
Keith Rohlig, your 20-year research of newbie employees and students, what's the most common fear that we have?
Well, we often, you know,
besides
I guess,
public speaking.
Besides public speaking, right. We fear rejection. We fear making bad first impressions. We sort of often will assume that everybody that we're going to be encountering are going to be evaluating us in some way. And oftentimes all of that anxiety will lead us to be reluctant and then, in the worst case, talk ourselves out of ever even approaching and putting ourselves into that new situation in the first place.
Are there studies that compare percentages of people who seek out new situations versus those who would do anything to avoid them?
Well, I think I haven't seen any specific studies that look at that, but it is true. And in fact, almost everybody I've interviewed, whether they're extroverted or introverted, can point to some kind of a situation, and it's often different for different people, where they just feel reluctant. For some, it's the, you know, it's the holiday party. For others, it's the joining a new health club or a church. Others, it's a networking event. But we all can point to something where that reluctance has been pretty strong as we can contemplate going into that situation.
In the book, you talk about the snow job, meaning the smile, nod, or wave to others. Just that sort of very, very minimal contact with people we may pass in the hall at work or at school.
Yeah, and exactly. And often what it comes from is if we don't, either us or the other person doesn't make that sort of initial effort when we're aware of each other to introduce ourselves, it's sort of this weird social norm that it becomes a little bit more awkward to do it later. I mean, for instance, if a new neighbor moves in next to you and you don't approach them and they don't approach you right away, then all of a sudden, after a while, it feels like, man, I should have asked them before. And as you said, what happens is they drive by, you smile and wave, they wave at you, you know, they're out mowing the lawn, you wave, but you're too embarrassed to go approach them and say, hey, you know, I should have come up earlier and introduced yourself. And as a result, I have seen, and people have told me, where they've had, you know, this smile, nod, and wave relationship with somebody for months or years, and they just feel like it's gotten too far for them to change it. And it's unfortunate, because if we'd have just gotten over that anxiety and introduced ourselves, we could potentially have a wonderful relationship there.
Is there a way to change it just by being honest and going up and saying, you know, I really regret that I didn't introduce myself when you first moved in, but, you know, I'd like to get to know you better. What do you do for a living? Or what about your kids?
Exactly. Because if you're feeling embarrassed in that situation, particularly with neighbors or with others, you can almost bet that the other person is feeling the same way. So instead of getting scorn from them and saying, oh, you're right, you should never, you know, you should have come up to me and long ago, most likely what you're going to get is relief and gratitude because they're feeling the same way. And as long as somebody makes that first move, you often end up laughing about it. And then the relationship goes from there.
You, as Joe mentioned, you've been studying this newcomer experience for a couple of decades now. Why your interest? Are you a naturally reluctant or introverted newcomer, or are you an extrovert?
Well, I guess they all say that sometimes all books are autobiographical. So I'm one of those more introverted folks. I found myself being transferred to Japan many years ago on an overseas assignment and showing up with my bags in this completely foreign culture. And the anxieties I felt in trying to make sense of the language and the culture and the people and all these strangers led me to be interested in this. And as a result, I continued to study it. And yeah, I think I've gotten better at it over time through practice, but I'm still a little reluctant to enter into new situations. And heck, even the one we're doing right now, you know, we're engaging in a conversation between what were strangers a few minutes ago.
Right.
You know, you bring a little anxiety into that as well.
Well, let's look at what you call the five key skills, which will help us succeed as newcomers, because it's a big part of your book. And let's take them one by one and talk about them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the five basic skills, what I found is that when I've really tried to separate the people who seem to be really comfortable in new situations and the ones that are more reluctant, it's less about whether they're extroverted and introverted, and it's more about how comfortable they are doing five key things. Being able to be comfortable introducing themselves to strangers, remembering their names once they've met them, asking questions of people they don't know, taking that relationship from that first introduction to whatever kind of relationship you're trying to build, and then also just being the beginner, trying new things and making mistakes and in front of people that you're just getting to know. To the extent that we can get better and more comfortable with those five things, I've found that people tend to be more comfortable in new situations.
Well, taking the first one, introducing ourselves to strangers, and I'd like to couple that with asking the questions, because many people are averse to small talk, you know, just chit-chat. What do you, when you introduce yourself, and what kind of questions are you referring to so it doesn't become just small talk?
Right. I think a lot of times when people think of small talk, they're thinking of the weather and the sports team, you know, sort of things that we potentially might have in common, but we may not be that interested in it. I think the best way to think of small talk is imagining that you're really trying to learn something about that other person. And by asking questions and getting them to talk, they open up about themselves and who they are, and it's a process of discovery. So that if you can see it as more of a conversation of discovery rather than, oh, okay, we're going to talk about the weather and the, you know, the local sports team, I think it will, you'll approach it with more interest, you'll ask better questions, they'll ask better questions in return, and you'll have a much better conversation than just simply small talk.
Well, talk about the fine line that may be between shyness with a new individual or a new group and overcompensating, maybe being too proactive, the kind of person who's has their grandkids' pictures out on an airplane right away when you want to read.
Right, exactly. You know, and you hope that people have enough sort of awareness of the other person to be able to read the signals as to when they don't want to see your grandkids. Sometimes one of the challenges I found is that when people get nervous in new situations, they do one of two things. They either talk too much, and they're the kind that will pull out the photos and drone on, and the other person's, you know, eyes glaze over, or the opposite, which is you don't say anything. You let the other person do all the talking, and while they probably enjoyed having that conversation with themselves, they walk away. We're really not really knowing much about you, and that's not a really good way to start a relationship.
We're speaking with Keith Rolag, PhD. He's an organizational researcher, management consultant, and he's an award-winning educator. He's an associate professor of management and chair of the management division at Babson College in Wellesley, Mass. He's written What to Do When You're New. A short break. We'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. We're speaking with Keith Rolag. We're talking about his book, What to Do When You're New, How to Be Comfortable, Confident, and Successful in New Situations. If you'd like to call in with a comment or a question, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576. Or if you're a little shy, you can call. You can email radio@wlrn.org. Radio@wlrn.org, yes.
I was just going to say, if you're you can tell us if you're a successful newcomer or a reluctant newcomer.
Well, Keith Rolag, we always like sports analogies. Tell us about punt, pass, and kick of newcomer success.
Well, you know, if you think about it, the skills I described earlier, going up and introducing yourself, asking questions, remembering names, these are just fundamental skills that we do all the time when we find ourselves in new situations. They are kind of like the punt, pass, and kick skills for being new. Part of the challenge with it is, you know, we're never really taught how to do these things. It's not something that we learn in school very well. I mean, we might learn how to ask questions in school, but the only way we're taught is to raise your hand and wait for the teacher to call you, which is, you know, a good skill when you're in school, but outside of school doesn't work so well. So I've found in my interviews that the people who have gotten better at this have just, you know, through practice, through reflection, have simply learned how to do these fundamental skills. And if you and they are skills that you can get better at. And if you try and you work at it and you do get better, it just makes it a whole lot easier to walk into new situations because you're confident in these fundamental things you need to do.
Well, let's talk about the learn and remember names, because many people have such trouble with that. What do you suggest, what methods do you suggest to remember names so that it's not a stumbling block?
Sure. One of the most universal things I found in my research is that almost everybody, and I literally mean 90% of people I've talked to, have said, you know, I'm really bad with names. But there was always somehow this assumption that everybody else is good with it, but in reality it isn't the case. We are bad with names because our brains process proper names like John and Mary, you know, or Joseph and Bonnie, but differently than we process other information. And the connection between what we know about people and that name starts out pretty weak. And that's just the way that our brains are hardwired. So if you feel that you're bad with names, don't feel bad, because it's just simply a product of evolution and how our brains got created and the late invention of language and other things that just make it harder for us to remember names.
So do you have a method, a tried and true method that works?
Sure. Okay. I think the first thing to realize is that in over half the time, neuroscientists have found that when we blank on somebody's name, the next time we see them, it's usually because we didn't pay enough attention to it to the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So if the first thing you can do is make a mental commitment when you know you're going to be having an introduction, you know somebody's going to be saying that name, that you make certain you're paying attention in that 1 second when they say it. Because if you don't, it's not going to stay in your brain and you're not going to really get it into memory. The best way you can do that is to make a habit of repeating their name as soon as they say it. One, that forces you to pay attention to it, and two, if you got it wrong, you can, you know, get it corrected right away. As you talk to people in that conversation, whether it's small talk or not, quiz yourself mentally as you're looking at them. Do you remember their name? And if you don't, at the end of the conversation, just say something like, you know, my name is Keith, you know, but I've already forgotten your name. Could you let me know? Usually they'll reply back without any problem. In fact, they usually are thrilled because they've forgotten your name already as well. And then finally, probably the most important thing is as soon as you can, write their name down. Because it turns out that our brains are infinitely better at recognizing the right name than to try to pull that name out of memory. And if you keep lists of those names, whether it's in a little notebook you carry or your phone or whatever, oftentimes if you see somebody coming and you realize you've blanked on them, you can often pull out that list, and 9 times out of 10 you'll instantly recognize the right name and save yourself a little bit of embarrassment. And then finally, if you do have those lists and you know you're going into an event where you're going to see those people again, if you look at those lists in advance, it primes your brain, gets those neural pathways charged up again, and it dramatically increases the chance that you'll actually remember their name when you see them.
Of course, most of the memory experts say you should associate. It's never really worked for me. For example, if I meet Bonnie, I could think of, oh, Scotland. Or I meet Keith Rolag, I could think the Rolling Stones or something like that, to try and lodge it in your brain.
Sure, and actually those techniques work great. And in fact, they're the basis of every memory book ever written. The challenge is that we're often trying to do those in the middle of an introduction. And in the middle of an introduction, we got so many things else that's going on. We're trying to make conversation. We're worried about whether we got food in our teeth or what we're going to do afterwards or how firm the handshake was. And the last thing we can do is sort of add one more mental trick on top of that and trying to imagine these images. The best time to do that kind of memory is either before you meet them or after you meet them, when you're back, you know, at home or in your office, and you can look at those names and you have sort of the freedom and the focus to create that imagery. But most of the time we try to do this in the heat of the moment while we're talking to people, and we just can't multitask that well.
Again, if you'd like to join in the conversation, we have a few lines open. We have a few minutes left. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email is radio@WLRN.org. Maybe you're a newcomer in Palm Beach County and you're listening on 90.7 HD2 or 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. We'd love to hear from you.
Be our maiden caller.
That's right.
Keith Rolag, let's say you're starting a new job and there's a whole new group of people and you don't really know the dynamics. What's the best way to find out without committing too much to any certain direction?
Obviously, asking questions. First of all, introducing yourself. The more that you can build relationships with people, the more you'll have a better sense of sort of what the political dynamics and the norms and all of that. The extent that you can get sort of into the lunch crowd, because it turns out in my research I found that lunch is one of the most critical times for you to kind of ask those newcomer questions and get people sort of in more of an informal mode and more open. But most of all, it's also just listening and watching. And over time, you'll sort of get a sense as to how things work there. But you won't get it if you just stay back in your cubicle and you wait for other people to approach you, because they're probably as nervous as you are or as reluctant as you are, and that might never happen, and you won't be able to sort of make sense of that new place.
You talk about something that I found really important, that our mindset is important, and focusing on a learning mindset rather than a performing mindset. But how do we do that? How do we switch from being performers to learners? Because our brains have evolved, really, to focus on performance.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, for much of human history, if you lived in small groups and resources were limited and only the strongest were the ones that got the most food and shelter and mates, performing was everything. We've inherited that into a world where, yes, performance is important, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's a matter of life and death. And on top of that, unfortunately, much of our educational systems that are so focused on tests and, standardized exams and GPAs to get into college sets us up to enter new situations worried about how we're going to perform, when in reality, in most of the situations we enter in these days, you know, the consequences of us not performing perfectly or making a mistake is pretty small. So you're right. It's tough to do, but I think if you can sort of think about new situations, about what's going to be interesting, what are you going to learn, what do you hope to discover about the situation or the other people, and to give yourself a break and just say, hey, you know, I'm going to make some mistakes. I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm going to stumble and do the wrong thing at the wrong time. But the consequences of that usually is far less than our primitive brains will make us think. And if we can realize that, we'll be a lot less anxious walking into that situation.
Honey wants to know how you gauge whether you're hesitant to engage in conversation with a neighbor or someone similar because of anxiety, or because you've made a reasoned decision that you're just not interested in allocating your time in that way, even if that reasoned decision is based on your anxious reaction, perhaps combined with your lack of interest in getting to know someone.
That's right. And around and around and around it goes.
Right.
Now, one of the challenges is that we, over our lifetime, build a mindset up about new situations. We develop a set of assumptions about how things will go, how people will evaluate us, what's acceptable and not acceptable. And it's very, very true that you can sort of create a mindset that will either convince you that all will be well, or often, as you said, you can sort of talk yourself out of approaching somebody, introducing yourself. I think in talking with people, I've found that most people know when it's important. You know, they know when the new neighbor moves next door. Yes, you may not build a long-standing, wonderful, best friend relationship, but sure, you know, it's really nice and helpful for you to at least go introduce yourself. And if you find a connection and it develops further, great, but at least you made the effort. And I think that's the difference. We all can be hesitant. I mean, introverts in many cases are often reluctant, not because it's the anxiety, it's just social interactions or too many of them get exhausting. And that can be the reason why they just, you know, don't want to do it. But we often know when strategically it's probably a thing to put aside that anxiety and just go for it.
Well, we have to be running soon. We apologize to Patricia and Marcus who were on the phone.
Yeah.
But we've unfortunately run
late.
Out of time. It's been a pleasure to speak with. What was your name again?
Very good.
Keith Rolag, PhD, organizational researcher, management consultant, award-winning educator, associate professor of management, and chair of the management division at Babson College in Wellesley, Mass. What to Do When You're New is the name of his book, How to Be Comfortable, Confident, and Successful in New Situations. Thank you so much, Keith, for being with us.
Thank you, and it's been great to be here today.
Our
nice
pleasure.
To meet you. Food and Dining up next.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper.
Haven't heard that theme in a couple of weeks.
That's right. Linda is with us for another Thursday Food and Dining program, but we missed her last week. She was Fooding in Boston.
Lots of lobster.
Very
lobster,
nice.
Lobster rolls.
Mm-hmm. Whole lobsters.
Well, that's the place. So today we'll learn more about the agricultural breadbasket of Miami-Dade. It's called the Red Lind without an S.
Okay. Thank you for telling me that.
And we'll learn about someone who's been part of that history for nearly 60 years.
Right. Well, it's great to be with you. Have you been to Robert Is Here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, for those who don't know what it is, it's a farm stand that's an institution. It's part of tourist attraction. It's part gateway to the agricultural red land. And yes, there is a Robert. And his name is Robert Moling. He's here to tell us his amazing story. He started the stand and about the thousands of visitors that go there each year. So let's welcome Robert Moling.
Good afternoon. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we have a cornucopia here.
Oh, my.
Beautiful
it's
colors.
Gorgeous.
It's just
yeah.
All the things he's brought for us. We're going to talk about that. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions or maybe comments for Robert Is Here? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Email is radio@WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns in the Miami Herald. You can also read his wine column that is in the Saturday food section of the Miami Herald. Hi, Fred. What are we drinking today?
Well, I'm going to talk about wine for all those veggies. Would you believe Zinfandel with zucchini?
Well, maybe we will. We'll find out. Okay, Robert Moling, you started Robert Is Here when you were 6 years old.
Yeah, actually, it was my dad who stuck me out on the corner. He had a problem. His cucumbers hadn't sold a week prior, and he had no money to buy boxes for the next harvest. He went to the broker. No, we didn't sell them, and we're going to dump them. We just don't have nothing to do with them. And my dad needed those boxes back. So he said, I'll come and get my cucumbers back so I could dump them out and use the boxes over again. So that's what he did. And the following Saturday, which was a day or so later, he stuck me on the corner to maybe raise a couple nickels for...
A nickel a cucumber.
Whatever, yeah. Just whatever he could raise. He was dead broke.
And did you get enough to get the boxes?
Absolutely. Nobody stopped.
Oh,
wow. The day he put me out there. He used the used boxes to harvest the second crop. But the next day, my mom and dad, apparently, for the Sunday market, putting me out there, they decided maybe the drivers-by didn't see me. So I put up two signs that simply told the world that I was there.
Robert is here.
And I sold out and walked home. When you go to marketing class at the university, if you want to make a statement that asks a question, that's the hit. If you can make a statement that asks a question. My dad was a broken down farmer, and he simply said, Robert is here, as a statement. But it makes you a question. What's that?
Yeah, who's, you know? Robert?
So people stopped, and the little six-year-old kid out there, you know.
And the rest is really kind of history. But for those who haven't been there, now, I mean, you grew from a little stand where your family was practically, well, they were broke, to this enormous business. Tell us, what does it look like now?
Well, we do it still old school. I still add up on a paper bag like I did the first day because I had already learned my basic
math. Okay, at 6 years old.
There wasn't many items the first day. But as I went back every weekend with my signs, other farmers would bring me stuff. And you talk about really neat selling stuff that you didn't have to pay for, and we got to keep the funds from it, and that really helped us out.
They were bringing you their excess.
Well, they bring me corn.
Uh-huh.
It's just, if you see a kid on the side of the road, especially if you are a farmer.
A cute little six-year-old. Here,
yeah.
Please buy my stuff.
Yeah, and I was amazed how easy it was, because it was like a gimmick, but it wasn't a gimmick.
So they thought it was like a kid with a lemonade stand.
Right, yeah, right. But we were really hurting.
But you grew it. You were able to grow the business, buy more land.
My dad passed away very early. He died at 48 years old from leukemia.
Oh, dear.
And in 1960, we had Hurricane Donna. He lost part of his land because he couldn't pay for it. It was a teeny tiny amount of money for 5 acres of land. I think he paid $400 an acre, and he couldn't pay the mortgage on it. So that's how bad he was.
Well, I can't imagine what that 5 acres would be today.
I bought it shortly after he died. It came for sale, and I paid $7,500 an acre. And then I bought land behind it where I built my house, and I just kept on buying little pieces of land. The first piece of property I ever bought, I was 14, and I bought a 10-acre piece right down the street, and I still own that, too.
Yeah. Okay, but now if you go down to the Redlands, and you said it's at the corner of 192nd and
192nd Avenue
and
344th Street on route to the Everglades National Park. It's
and this huge now. It's a big, huge.
Well,
fruit
yeah,
stand.
We've really got
not a little boy on the corner anymore.
Yeah, I got my grandkids there. All of my four children come back from college, and they're all back with us. My daughters-in-laws, both of them.
They're all there.
They're all here.
So now, I was just told that you sell something like 1,500 milkshakes a day.
And a weekend we
and
can
a weekend?
Do more than that. And it's just
so
incredible.
I want to know, what's the recipe here?
Well, I want to just say that Melissa wrote in. She said, the girls and I in the office love to go to Robert's and get shakes during our lunch break. Warm regards, Melissa.
Okay, Melissa, we're going to get the recipe right now.
Okay.
What's the recipe for these shakes that make them so popular?
We use fresh fruit.
Uh-huh.
We never puree it ahead of time. It's left in its whole form, unless it's a liquid like key lime juice or orange juice. And we use the fresh orange juice. Fresh fruit thrown in the ice cream and then puree it in the ice cream. And
so the fresh fruit pureed in the ice cream. So what's about the proportion to proportion? Well,
oh,
first of
goodness.
All, this fresh fruit has to be really, really ripe by the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Proportion-wise,
yeah.
Believe it or not, I don't know those. I worked in there one day, and it was so hard. I vowed I would never work in there again. So my girls and boys that work in there, it's like grandma's recipe. You pour it in, go.
It depends.
You know, I know there's
is it
got,
vanilla? What kind of ice cream is it?
It's a vanilla soft serve like you'd buy at Dairy Queen. Yeah.
Oh, it's a soft serve.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
You know, I think another reason for your success is I was buying some avocados at your stand one time, and you asked me when I was going to use them, and I said, I need some for tonight, some for tomorrow night, and some for 3 or 4 days from now. And you were able to just poke your finger at a few avocados and give me each one that was perfectly ripe at the time I needed to use it. But I could never do that.
Yeah, well, as of today, I got 56 years of practice. And if you don't get it right after 56 years, you
don't get it.
But it's pretty basic. You know, once you learn, you know, by your own, because I love avocados and I know when to eat them. Mangoes, I'm really hooked on.
Now I want to go over this. The fruit. Let's talk about the fruit you've had in the studio because some of it is a bright
yeah.
purple, red purple
well, that
color.
Bright purple
and then
one.
Then we have an orange color.
Yeah.
And, right, so tell us.
The bright purple one is called a pitaya.
Pitaya.
Also known as dragon fruit.
Oh.
They have a white colored one. Now the white colored ones are a little less flavorful.
No.
The purple ones are just tremendous. It's not overpowering. You eat the seeds and all. You don't even know they're seeds. Kind of like a kiwi.
It's very soft and all. And Joe's
and
eating
sweet.
It right now.
Oh,
and he doesn't know that it stains.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I got napkins there somewhere for you. But the bright orange one is our papaya. We just started harvesting papaya.
I'll try that too.
But your papaya tastes... Sometimes... Papaya has something what I call a soapy kind
yeah.
of flavor. What is that?
When you bring them from the imported
right.
parts of the world, rather than local, they refrigerate them. And papaya hate to be refrigerated. And you can cool them when they're dead ripe and eat them the next day. It's okay. But when you pick them not quite ripe and cool them, it puts a little bitterness to it. And sometimes it generates a smell that people don't like. You know?
Yeah.
But these are good.
I saw on your website that you just reopened today.
Today, my crew, my two boys, and one of my daughter-in-laws is taking care of the ship.
And so, you had renovations?
Oh, yeah. We paint every year and clean, and we put in our new vegetable farm. We got broccoli, collard greens, cabbage, green tomatoes that never turn red.
Ooh, yeah.
Incredible. And I got Brandywine tomatoes. The green tomatoes are called.
And they're good fried, of course.
No.
No.
You eat them when they're red, when they're soft.
I see.
Right. And I want to talk about
the most incredible tomato flavor of any tomato.
Hmm. Yeah. Right, it's fabulous. But there's something green there that I had no idea.
That's a guava. Uh-huh. That's an Asian guava. This is the China white. And when you eat the guava,
really crunchy.
You eat the skin and all.
He's eating like
the
an
skin's
apple.
The best part.
Oh, you
but
do
now
eat
I
the
put
skin.
This up on the webs, on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, that makes a difference.
I'm holding something that is amazing here.
This, to us that live down here in South Florida, we generally have a house with this as our landscape. It's called a Monstera Deliciosa. And the green kernels will fall off of it when it's ripe. And you throw the green kernels away, and you eat the white fruit on the inside.
That is amazing.
The white
fruit
is almost
sweet.
Like a banana and a sweetness. Yeah. And it's something I realized. I've got this in my yard. I mean, all of us, what is it, a philodendron?
Philodendron, yes.
Wow.
It's just amazing. Before we go to break, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, Robert writes, I'm proud to say I not only have known Robert for decades, but I helped educate at least two of his sons. His kids were always modest, hardworking students, often ended up at the top of their class. Thanks, Robert, for your focus on pure, wholesome foods and quality of produce.
Well, thank you for listening.
Do you know who that is?
No.
Robert Pike.
Bob Pike.
Well, on that note,
I'm not a name.
You'll think about it.
Yeah.
You're not a name. You should have just listened to our last.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so we'll take a break and he'll think about it.
Okay,
we're talking with Robert is here, owner Robert Moling. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we'll take a short break and be back with more. We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Robert is here owner, Robert Moling. He's been telling us the story of his famous produce stand and feeding us with these wonderful, wonderful produce he's brought with us. Robert has a book called, well, guess what? It's Robert is Here.
Robert is Here.
And yes, and he's going to be at the Miami Book Fair this November 22nd, that's Sunday, at 3:30. So come and see him. And also, next weekend, November 14th and 15th, at Robert is Here in the Redlands, he's going to have a book signing, and his man who wrote the book with him, Cesar Becerra, yes, is going to be there as well. And I'll bet there's going to be lots of milkshakes down there.
Yeah.
So that'll be nice. By the way, I'm also going to be at the book fair, so come and see me. I'll be there on Saturday, the 21st, from 3 to 4, and I'll be cooking up a storm on Sunday, the 22nd.
What are you cooking?
From 2 to 3. From my new books from
I know that, but
I'm going to make a chili.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and also a curry chicken
turkey
salad.
Turkey chili.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's from my books for the American Diabetes Association. So go to the fair website and look up everything that's going on at the fair. Meanwhile, let's talk about dinner in minutes. And this is going to be an onion, pepper, and mushroom pizza. It's faster than sending out, and it's very easy on your pocketbook. So you want to begin with a thin crust pizza base, which you can buy in the store. Now, really thin ones were great. I line a baking sheet with foil. That's to save cleanup. And I put the pizza base on the foil. And then I put some sliced tomatoes, maybe some of those wonderful ones coming out of Robert is Here, those heirloom tomatoes on it. And then I put a little oregano. If you can get fresh oregano, that's even better. Some mozzarella slices over the tomatoes. Some mushrooms over the cheese and bell peppers and onions. Now, the order of how you place them on is important because that's how it'll cook faster. So you want something to takes a little longer to cook, the onions and all, you put them on the top layer. And I put that in the oven, 400 degrees, and in 15 minutes, you've got your pizza. Have a large salad with it, and it's simple and easy. That complete recipe, it's on my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. And Fred Tasker, you told me I'm going to have, what, zucchini with Zinfandel? What am
yeah,
I having?
Yes, wine with vegetables is my assignment. Linda always makes it as hard as she can on me. So we'll see.
But
if
we
I'm
love
up
you anyway,
it.
Fred.
I could take the easy way out and say pair the wine with the meat and let the veggies tag along behind, but that would be too easy. And there are lots of vegetarians and vegans out there who don't do meat. Right, Bonnie?
Right.
Now, that's true, especially now that the food police have outlawed bacon and ruined the rest of Joseph's life.
That's right. Exactly.
Anyway, these days, with it, wine writers have to be up on wine matches for all vegetable main courses for vegetarians. And we can't use the old crutch of slathering everything with cheese to create wine pairings because that wouldn't work for vegan. But still, this can be done. Vegetables are often mild in flavor, so you can match the wine to the spices and herbs in the dish. A few years ago, I wrote about a vegan Tamarack couple who held a Seder and served a nice rolled roast of tofu. And it was scented with sage and rosemary, so I could recommend a nice Sauvignon Blanc that had equal herbal flavors. Now, spicy veggie dishes like meatless chili or Tex-Mex black bean tacos or Thai veggie stews with zingy bird's eye chilies want a slightly sweeter wine, just as a spicy meat dish would. So a lightly sweet Riesling or Chenin Blanc would be nice. Now, if you want to build a veggie dish around a red wine, you can do that too. Not, of course, a bombastic Cabernet Sauvignon, but more likely a softer, easier wine like Pinot Noir or Shiraz. And you can serve that with a rich lasagna made of vegan cheese, mushrooms, squash, in a rich tomato sauce. And the same thing is true, of course, with a big, meaty, grilled portobello sandwich, with or without that slice of American cheese product. Or even better, when Thanksgiving arrives, which won't be long, you could serve that soft red wine with your delicious tofurkey. And this is all so healthy that now you can combine an all-vegetable diet with that one or two glasses of wine that doctors say are good for you, and you'll probably live forever.
Happily. Fred Tasker, thank you very much. Great advice as always. Now, there is one more product here that we haven't been tasting, and it's the white one.
Yes, with the seeds?
With the seeds.
That is the best. Yes.
What is that?
An Asian guava. This is called the China White. It's originally from China, grown here in South Florida. It's one that I don't grow those. They have to bloom on the tree, and you cover it with a bag before it gets just when it sets.
I wonder what you can't see because it's not television, but he's building the bag with his hands and he's showing us how it's done.
And then,
so I guess they're expensive with that much individual attention.
Well, they tend to get really wormy if you don't cover them with the bag. And when you bite into them, you have worms all through guavas.
What does it look like when it's whole? Because we just had the slices of it.
You know what chayote squash is?
Yeah, it almost looks like a pear.
Okay.
It's green, and it almost
pear.
Looks like a pear.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about the one that this came from?
No, that is guanabana.
Ah.
Okay, that's right. The guanabana. That's what she's talking about. How delicious
okay.
It is.
The guanabana has little black seeds
it's
in it.
It's also known, I think, as soursop.
Soursop.
Yes, right.
Yeah. In Jamaica, they call them soursop.
Uh-huh.
It has properties that are incredible. It kills cancer cells in humans at a rate of 1,000 or more times than chemotherapy.
That's without the seed.
Yeah.
Guanabana. Where's it from?
We grow them here. Doesn't like to grow here. Our cold weather tears it up. But
what cold weather?
I don't know. Some years we have cold. Last year it was easy on them.
Okay.
But right now we're able to import them from Grenada. That's the only country they let them come from.
Oh.
Grenada doesn't have any medflies. And we're having a problem right now with Oriental fruit fly from other imported fruit.
So importing the fruit is what brings in the pests.
Yeah, afraid so.
Right.
But the guanabana, the tincture, which is a concentrate once a day under your tongue, is just bombards your body with the whatever it
problems.
Is. I'm not a chemical.
Right.
But it's just wonderful flavor. In my mind, I think it's the best tasting fruit of any fruit grown.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
It reminds me of lychee a little.
A little bit, yeah.
All of these are just delicious. There's Someone's waiting on the phone. Bill in Marathon, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call. Robert, this is Dried Mango Bill Summers.
Oh, hello, Bill.
Hello there. I haven't seen you for 2 years. I heard you're going to be on this program.
Well, I'm glad you called.
We only have a minute left, so did you want to say something else?
Yeah, okay. Well, in the case that a big shout out, a hearty hello. Also, you still have the zoo in the back. It's not really a zoo, but, you know, a farm animal.
We have our farm animals, yeah.
You know, the children bring families out to your place because it's not just a matter of getting milkshakes and, you know, wonderful fruit, but, you know, it's a day out. It's an adventure.
Yeah. It's my family enjoying your family, and I
okay,
love it.
Well, and that's true. Thank you so much for your call, Bill. There's a lot of attractions going on there. You have music every week, and this next weekend coming up, you have your book signing and, of course, the milkshakes, because today's your opening day. So, you know, hop on down there, and you'll have a wonderful time.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for bringing all this.
Indeed.
Fabulous. Oh,
thank you.
Food.
Our pleasure.
It was really delicious.
Get
Robert,
you out.
Robert was here.
It's an aura. Robert always is here. Yeah. No matter where he's at.
Okay. And the stand is his stand. It's more than a stand. It's his huge farm stand. Is located at 192nd Avenue and 344th Street. That's at the en route to the Everglades National Park.
Yes.
And so come on down. It's in Homestead. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie Berman, you ate well today.
We certainly
nice to
did.
You.
Thank you.
Well, next week we're going to be talking about the Urban Oasis Project here with Art Friedlich. And I'm Linda Gastenheimer. So join me then.
Welcome back, Linda.
Nice to be with you.
And thanks for joining us today. Tune in for Monday's Topical Currents when we rebroadcast a fascinating interview with an English professor. No, it's not about Chaucer or Shakespeare, because Jonathan Gottschall took a rather odd pastime, the full contact mixed martial arts game. He's written The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. That's Monday at 1 o'clock. Today's program produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. The dragon fruit does stain fingers. And for your convenience, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
And again, we want to welcome our listeners at 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches and 90.7 HD2 West Palm Beach.
Welcome indeed. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastenheimer, Fred Tasker, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.